Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. The time that we're recording this show, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are 423.88 parts per million. That's pretty close to 425 parts per million, which is, do the arithmetic, 75 parts per million above the 350 that scientists tell us we need to be at. So the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are already in an unsafe place. We need to draw that down. And it turns out that we only have 2,105 days left until the year 2030, by which time we must reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. So there's some numbers to give you a sense of urgency. Clock's ticking. Recently on our show, we have been discussing what's called decarbonization. And of course, decarbonization is a buzzword for essentially getting fossil fuels out of your life. And what are fossil fuels? Fossil fuels are gasoline, the oil that you might heat your house with, the natural gas that you might heat your house with, all of that sort of stuff that you're burning in order to do things produces carbon. And to decarbonize your home, you need to get rid of those fossil fuels. Decarbonizing your home is a noble goal, but there's various ways to do it, and it's useful to think about how you would decarbonize. How would you get rid of your hot water heater? How would you get rid of your the furnace in the basement and go over to a heat pump? Those are legitimate questions, because here in Massachusetts, a lot of the carbon pollution comes from people's residences, and there is a move in the state to essentially renovate a million homes before the year 2030 to install non-fossil fuel heating systems across the board. It's a big project. So one of the things we're trying to do in these episodes that we're thinking about the problem of decarbonization is to talk to people who have actually begun the process of decarbonizing their homes. There are successes and failures. There are lessons learned. And I think that talking about real people who try to do real things in the real world and decarbonizing their homes is both inspiring and educational because, dear listener, it helps you get a handle on the things you need to know and ways to think about the issue if you are sitting wondering how you are going to address the decarbonization in your home. So to that end, we have someone with us who's begun this process. His name is David. David, welcome aboard. How are you doing?
Great, Ted. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Well, it's great to have you here. David's a friend of mine. He's here in our small town outside of Boston, and he's begun this process. So tell me, David, what's your definition of decarbonization, and how do you What have you done? Why do you think it's important? And why did you, let me ask this question specifically, why did you worry enough to begin to think about decarbonizing your house?
Well, I wanted to eliminate carbon dioxide wherever I could. So actually the first step was with my car. When I turned 62 and a half or whatever, I learned that I could take money out of my 401k without penalty. And I went out and bought a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, which was a Prius Prime from Toyota. And that car, I had been driving a car that got about 20 miles per gallon, as a lot of people do. And so this car, you know, the reading says 90 miles per gallon on the inside the car. I actually measure how many gallons of gas I put in and stuff. And so it's actually not quite that good, but it's up to 83. So in order to get 83 miles per gallon, you do need to use electricity as well as gas. But the electricity jacks up the normal Prius MPGs of like, you know, 50 or 60 miles per gallon to a higher level. And you have the fun of driving an electric vehicle at a lower cost point than you might if you had a full electric vehicle. I guess my goal ultimately would be to have a full electric vehicle, but So far, I've been driving this car for about 4 years, and I do about 20,000 miles a year, and it's been great. I love it.
So tell me, how do you charge it up? Is it like a 110-volt plug in the garage that you plug into?
Yeah, that's one of the real advantages of the plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, especially the smaller ones like a Prius. They can plug a charge off of a regular 110 plug, so you don't have to, you know, get an electrician to put in an expensive dryer plug, if you will, in your garage. Mm-hmm. That can pump out a lot of electricity. Now, if I did that, I could charge it in 2 hours instead of 6 hours. But, you know, 6 hours isn't too bad. And usually that works just fine.
And so if you have one of these hybrid, plug-in hybrids, I guess they're called, how far do you go on the battery before the gas kicks in? Let me be clear. You're saying this is a thing where the car will drive as long as the battery is above a certain level, and then if it needs to, it turns on a gas engine, right?
That is correct. And this car, and it depends a lot on the speed and so forth, you know, you can do 20, 25 miles, best case conditions with the battery. But a lot of what you do once you own these cars is, you know, like if I have a trip to the grocery store or something like that, I can do that full electric. You know, all mm-hmm. the local trips are full electric. If I have a longer trip, I usually stay on the battery until I get on the highway. And then as soon as I get on the highway, you can hit a button and turn on the gas engine and preserve your battery for the low speed trips. Because on the highway, the battery goes pretty quick.
Right. Right. Interesting. But I mean, yeah. Just be getting around town is essentially all electric.
It's all electric, very quiet operation. I don't have the newest generation of Prius Prime. The newest generation of Prius Prime, they've upped the full electric range to about 40 miles. So, you know, that is a moving target. But
and of course, that all is in sync with the everyone's heard about electric vehicles and the Biden push to give everyone an electric vehicle, blah, blah, blah. So that's
Right. So, I mean, for, you know, quite a bit lower cost point, I've reduced my gasoline usage by, you know, 75%. So I consider that a pretty good win, at least a step in the right direction. As you know, what's going on now with EVs is a lot of the EVs are switching over to the Tesla plug. And if you don't have the Tesla plug built into the car, you have to use an adapter. And the adapters can get hot, and you know, it's just one more thing to go wrong. So it'll be nice next year when pretty much most of the cars come with the Tesla style plug with the great charging infrastructure that everybody can take advantage of.
Right. And so that I'm clear, we're saying that the different electric vehicles have different prongs on the plug that you're plugging in, and that Tesla has the sort of preeminent dominant arrangement, and everyone's moving to that configuration. So now it's more universal charging.
It's a much smaller and elegant solution. And when you have a plug-in hybrid vehicle like I do, you really don't worry about charging infrastructure much, because when you're on the road, you know, you're more than likely you're going to just switch to gas, and gas is easy to get, but you charge it when you're at home, when it's mm-hmm. easy to charge.
Right.
So, right. The plug-in hybrid electric vehicles pretty much can't do the DC fast charging that, you know, the full electric vehicles really need to charge efficiently.
Mm-hmm. But you consider that a success, and it is a success. You've decarbonized most of your transportation by having this plug-in hybrid and running around town on a battery, right?
Yeah, and you know, as folks retire and so forth, you know, Toyota is a very reliable brand. But on top of that, your needs to travel long distances diminishes. I'm still, you know, working, and I'm in sales, so I travel for a living. So there's more highway trips involved. But if I were retired, I think that my mileage would be much better, because I'd have a lot of short trips.
Interesting. Well, okay. Well, that's great. Okay, so you've got your car, your transportation section done. What about your house? Anything interesting going on with your home in terms of decarbonization?
Yeah, for over a year now, I've had solar panels on my house, and when, you know, even in the winter months, there's 22 panels, and they'll generate about 6,000 watts when they're really, you know, on a nice clear sunny day without too many clouds. And you know, you can get 30 or 40 kilowatts of electricity, kilowatt hours they're called, on a sunny day. And you know, depending upon the number of cloudy days and rainy days compared to sunny days, you know, your electric bill might go up and down, but it's still, especially as electric prices go up, I think that is the best deal for anybody considering a home improvement, because you get the 30% tax break for installing electric panels, and the panels should last for like 25 years. And usually the payoff is in 7 or 8 years. So if you can put enough panels on your house to cover your full electric needs, you know, essentially you pay for it in 8 years and you've got a hedge against inflation and you've got free electricity for maybe 18 years. So
tell me this, as I understand it, there are different business models under which you can buy solar panels. So
yes,
we've had people come visit us, try to convince us that we should lease solar, come visit our home to try and convince us to lease solar panels from this vendor who would put them on our roof, but the vendor would continue to own the solar panels and we would benefit from lower electrical costs. Is that the model that you, or did you go out and outright purchase them in your own name and put them on the roof?
I did end up purchasing them. And I, you know, the year before I put them up, I did replace the roof too. So I like that style, because if you do move and you know, the panels are on your roof, you're in kind of a complicated legal arrangement with the installer. And if you read all the fine print, you know, I went through that process, and you know, you could be in kind of a messy situation, and it might detract from the value of your home in a resale market. Whereas, you know, when you own the panels outright, it's a huge plus for your house. Mm-hmm. And the laws are in place that adding solar panels to your property does not increase the value of your home for tax purposes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So you're not going to have a tax penalty for doing the right thing, if you will. And you're going to have a great investment that's really going to help the resale value of your home. And there'll be no strings attached for any potential buyers.
And I've asked that question. That's precisely the question I've asked of the people. And again, to be clear, we're saying that if I own a house, lease solar panels onto the roof from a supplier, and then the next year decide I'm going to move, then the person that's buying the house has to take on the lease. And conceivably, that is unattractive. But I've also heard the counterargument that a lot of people, certainly younger buyers, understand what the solar panels are doing, and it's an advantage. So, I mean, there's two sides to that coin, I think. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it all depends on who your controller, your installer is, and what kind of legal language they throw into the contract. I mean, you are really, you know, I would say if you do it, you might want to have a lawyer look over the fine print before you sign on the dotted line.
Interesting.
The one I looked at did not look favorable. There was actually verbiage to the fact that you would be buying the electricity back from the installer after you moved out of your home, which I was like,
oh, really?
That does not sound like a great arrangement.
Interesting. Okay, well, there you go. So buyer beware. Take a close look and know what you're buying, what you're getting into with the solar panels. I just wanted to make one other comment about the solar panels on the roof, because I saw an article in, I think it was Commonwealth Magazine, that said, even here in Massachusetts, there is increasingly a trend that the grid operators see that at midday, the grid operator does not have to supply as much power as it used to, because there are so many solar panels on people's houses that during the midday, like, people's houses are running off solar panels, and it's enough that ISO New England sees that, right? And they have to start turning off power plants because there's no demand for the electricity. And then as the sun goes down, all of a sudden the demand increases again back to more normal levels. It's just a fascinating phenomena. And they were saying is that as we bring on more and more batteries online and whatnot, that end of the day when the sun goes down is going to be taken up because there'll be batteries that are storing the sunlight from the noontime period. And there you go. It's a good thing.
Yeah, I do not have batteries in my home environment. It felt like I had pretty reliable power. Batteries are expensive, and they certainly don't come with a 25-year warranty either. Mm. So,
what I'm talking about is what are called industrial scale batteries that the grid has.
Oh, right? Okay.
So these huge, not huge, but I mean substantial batteries that soak up the power, and then at night, you know, everyone gets it. Although there are individual batteries you can put into your house, right? Tesla has some sort of a wall battery that stores power. But I'm talking about industrial scale, utility scale batteries that would be part of that management of the grid, the total grid. Wow.
But it is for folks who are looking at solar for their homes, the battery questions come up quite a bit. There are other brands besides Tesla as well. Mm-hmm. And so it's something to consider. Interesting too, some of the electric vehicles like the Ford F-150 Lightning actually have a way to use the car as the battery. So you can, if you lose power in your home, you could have your home powered by your truck.
Yeah, what a fascinating idea. I mean, it's like the future is going to be so different that, you know, you'll have your car will be connected into your house and be trading power back and forth in a way that your grandmother wouldn't have imagined.
Yes.
All right. So yes. You got your transportation, you got solar, get your electric generation component. Boy, you're covering all the waterfront. What else did you do in your house?
So a couple of heat pumps. The simple one was I had a gas hot water heater, and so I changed that over to a heat pump hot water heater. And the magic of that is that, you know, in Massachusetts, if you're a National Grid customer or an Eversource customer, you can get $1,000 off the price, $750 off the price of that at the point of sale. So you print a coupon, you take it to Home Depot or another retailer, and they take that right off the price, and you can load the thing in your minivan, as I did, brought it home, bought the other associated parts. Like these things require a little condensation pump. It's just a little pump that, you know, just a few drips of water come down, but you got to get rid of it, and PVC piping and things like that. And you also have to bring electrical power to this. So a gas hot water heater doesn't need to be connected electrically, but a heat pump hot water heater needs a 240-volt circuit breaker to power it. So all those things combined, but the magic of it is there's been electric hot water heaters for forever, really, you know, but gas was certainly less costly to operate. But the heat pump hot water heaters give you like a 3-to-1 cost savings, because the heat pump is 3 times more efficient than just using resistive heat to heat the water. So it is kind of magical. And
so let me just back up just to stay with you.
Yep.
Say, compared to an old fashioned electric hot water heater, which would have a coil in the tank that got red hot to heat the water up, that's a resistive system. You're saying the heat pump system, which is more taking advantage of, in a sense, the kind of heat that comes out from behind your refrigerator, right? The sort of warm air from your, that's
moving,
what's getting pumped
around
into the water.
Yeah.
That's much more efficient use of the electricity that you're putting in.
Right. And these are kind of smart hot water heaters too. They actually do have the resistive heat as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is turned off. I've never needed it. But if you, you know, had a high demand, you know, with a bunch of teenagers jumping in the shower at the same time, you might find that you need the resistive heat to fill in the gaps because the heat pump style doesn't heat the water up as quickly as resistive heaters do.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the demand isn't so high where in my household. So I never use resistive heat because I want to get that 3-to-1 advantage. And if someone gets a little chilly in the shower, well, you know, maybe it's time to turn the water off.
Did I hear you correctly say that you install a hot water heater yourself?
No. I had a plumber and electrician.
Oh, you had a plumber and an electrician. Yeah. Oh, did you have the 240 drop for you ready, or did you have to have that brought in as well?
So the hot water heater is like 5 feet from the load center.
Okay.
So it was an easy job.
Mm-hmm.
For the electrician and
did you used to have gas? I mean, hot water heater was a gas hot water heater.
Yes.
Which has now been, and you had to cap off that gas pipeline and you're all good to go.
Yep. So in that respect, I've completely eliminated one device that uses gas. You know, essentially, I still have a gas burning stove,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not a huge cook, but I love spaghetti. And I bought this inductive cooktop because it was it's just, you know, when you have to heat a big pot of hot water, you know, you're really using a lot of gas and it takes forever. With the inductive cooktop, it heats faster and it's just miraculous. I love making spaghetti now with my inductive cooktop. It's just a single burner one.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the sauce might be cooked at a low flame on the stove,
uh-huh.
or I might preheat it on the inductive cooktop or whatever, but it does reduce the gas a lot. And they do actually make, if you take your pots and you put a magnet on the bottom of them and the magnet doesn't stick, then that pot won't work with an inductive cooktop.
Right.
But
if it does stick, you're good to go.
If it does stick, you're good to go. But mine didn't, so I got a whole set of new pots. And the new pasta pot has a colander built into it
with a
glass top on it, and it makes making pasta so much fun. It's like we're having it like every week.
That's great.
Sunday is pasta night.
Well, I think – so I was extolling the virtues of the induction plate in a recent show that I made about my own experience. And, yeah, you can buy these – turns out we have one with two burners, right? Double wide, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I find that sometimes, at least when I put on like a lot of water. So I have in to heat up to make spaghetti. So sometimes I divide that up between the microwave and other ways to heat small mm-hmm. portions of water in the induction. But yeah, I mean, I love the induction cooking for like 90% of the stuff that I cook. It's just wonderful. And it's like this minor point, but the idea that I can set a pan to run at 210 degrees Fahrenheit and never boil at 212 degrees Fahrenheit because the thing is smart enough to hold the temperature and not just keep pumping out power. It's just this magic thing that you say, wow,
making eggs or something like that and you don't want the thing to get too hot, you know, using that temperature setting. I think we both have the Duxtop brand.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been good. And they make the pots too. They make a set of pots to match it. So.
So yes. And I think that, as I said last time, I'll say it again. I mean, it is a very inexpensive way. It's like 50 or 100 bucks to get one of these, right? And you're in the game. You started your decarbonization journey by just, and it's fun. I mean, if you like to cook, it's an interesting way to, you know, to come to terms with. I remember when I first bought the induction top, first thing I did was boil water. Right. And I had this shiny new pan with little magnets. So if you look at the bottom of the pan, sometimes there's little magnets in set into the pan, little circles. And you watch the water and it's boiling up and all these little beads from the magnets embossed into the bottom of the pan.
Yep.
But anyway, it's fun. And maybe we'll leave it there. Induction cooking is fun
it is fun. It is fun. And, but I guess to get to the biggest piece and the most expensive piece, or probably about the same investment as the solar was the heat pump switching from my system. And my house has forced hot water and additionally a air handler with a compressor outside that feeds the air handler with ductwork that feeds the first and second floor, but mainly the second floor.
And back up, let me just make sure you're saying that your home heating system is a gas system, but with forced hot water. So basically there's a baseboard and the system drives hot water through the baseboard. And that's how you keep the house warm, right?
Right. And that now I have a second way to keep the house warm by kind of repurposing what was an air conditioning system to be a heat pump that can also provide heat.
Mm-hmm.
So the hot air comes through the vents where the air conditioning comes through in the summertime. But it is designed to turn off per my installer around the freezing point. So it doesn't work in the bitterly cold. I think if you had a heat pump, if you had a forced hot air system for heating, you might find a compressor heat pump that could work, in very cold temperatures and maybe completely replace your gas heating system. But with the hot water, forced hot water, you can't get a heat pump to heat the hot water hot enough to work with the baseboard. So you're mm-hmm. kind of stuck. So this is one of the challenges of, a 30-year-old home trying to make it, a green home is a challenge. Now, that being said, there's no reason why you can't add more heat pumps. The ductless mini splits, as they're called.
Describe those. This is a thing that hangs on the wall in an individual room, like a space heater kind of thing. Right?
Yeah, it mounts in the wall. And, this is something that you typically would have definitely a contractor put in for you. But you can have one compressor type unit outside feeding multiple heads inside the home. Mitsubishi seems to be the one who specializes in that functionality. So a lot of the contractors I spoke to about those kinds of systems were quoting the Mitsubishi brand. And, I could do that, but it would be a significant investment to, mm-hmm. More or less make it so that I could completely turn off the gas heating system.
And so a couple of questions, or one is a statement. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the reason it's called a mini split, the mini split system, you hear that once you start talking about decarbonization, you hear about mini splits all the time.
Yep, yep.
The split is that there are sort of two systems. One is like the air vent is on the inside of the house, and on the outside of the house is some kind of the radiator portion of it, right? And that
yes.
thing is a standalone kind of unit. Is that your understanding?
Well, they're mini splits, but some of them will feed multiple heads.
So the outside part goes back to like a central air conditioning thing. As I say, it's split. There's an inside heart split from the outside half. Saying the outside half is.
You can have maybe, I don't know exactly what the limit is, but at least three wall-mounted units that would provide heating and cooling in different parts of your house. And usually, like on a ground floor level, you could possibly get away with just having one unit. The harder part is upstairs, where you have all the bedrooms and people close door, want to close the doors at night and so forth. The air doesn't really circulate well, and having mini splits in every bedroom is pretty cost prohibitive. So,
So tell me, let me go back to your house. What you're saying is that correct me if I'm wrong, you had an air conditioning compressor outside. You replace that with one that is both an air conditioner and a heat pump, and it uses the air conditioning venting, and you preserved the gas heater in the basement and have
yes.
some kind of a control that switches back and forth between those two things depending on the temperature. Is that
yes,
fair?
There is a smart thermostat that automatically swaps from the heat pump to the gas boiler as the temperature drops below 30 degrees.
Interesting. Interesting.
So
then tell me this. Well, I guess the final question is, in terms of what was your experience in getting the money to do this? So there's rebates. There's lots of rebates floating around. I think that you probably did a lot of your work before the rebates became as generous as they are today. But how did that work for you?
Well, I spoke to a number of contractors and got quotes. You always want to get at least three quotes on anything this big. And only one of the contractors was able to, or suggested that for a cost-effective system of roughly $25,000 investment, I could get the $10,000 rebate, which is the full rebate. That's as much of a rebate you're going to get on a heat pump as possible. Mm-hmm. So I found that attractive enough to move forward. Now, there's a dual benefit. You know, one, you're using less gas to heat, but you're also, because the air compressor that I got rid of had an efficiency rating of like 10, and the one that replaced it was like 20. So it uses for cooling, it uses about half the electricity that the old system did.
Interesting. Interesting. Wow. And, so you went in both in the summer and the winter.
Yeah. And the other thing is that the old compressor was, you know, when it's on, you know, it's loud and it runs at full speed all the time. And that's part of the way they make those systems, you know, cost effective. The new system heat pump made by Bryant, which is, I think, part of Carrier, and it works with variable frequency motors. So the motors can turn very reasonable slow speeds, and the system is really whisper quiet. So instead of having something that when it's on, it's loud and annoying, it's now something that's very quiet, and you can barely even tell that it's on.
So tell me, what advice do you have for the poor person who's just beginning this journey, just starting to say, I wonder what I should do about my house. What can I do? What can I do? What advice would you give them?
Well, be opportunistic. And, you know, if you're, you know, water heaters are probably something that, you know, only going to last like 10 years or so. So it's a good thing to, if you're going to need a new water heater anyway, that certainly is the, you know, I think for a few thousand dollars, you can upgrade to a heat pump hot water heater. So that's a good thing. The inductive cooktop is another good thing if you have a gas burning. I mean, you could go to a full induction range, but that's a fairly major expense because you're going to need a 240-volt outlet for your new inductive range. You're going to have to get an electrician in. You're going to have to get a plumber in to cap off the gas, you know, remove that, mm-hmm. put in an expensive, you know, new inductive range. So that's a bit of a larger expense. But after that, I think, you know, there's if people have a forced hot air system that's gas or oil, taking a look at a heat pump is a really good idea. Like I said, you're going to spend less money cooling the house as well because the heat pumps are so efficient.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's interesting. I need to seek out, for this kind of discussion, someone who does have a totally forced hot air system, right? Because then you can, then the heat pumps produce hot air best, right? So if you've got a hot air heating system, that's where it's most compatible, the easiest solution, and find out what people's experiences was there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they'll save a bunch of money in the cooling season with a more efficient system.
And I think that this is the way of the future, is that we are looking to move everyone needs to be thinking about this, and everyone is eventually going to have to replace every utility in their house, right? You're going to have to replace the stove. You're going to have to replace the hot water heater. Eventually, you're going to have to replace the heater. You don't have to go out and proactively do anything because the problem will come to you eventually, right? Your job is to be ready when that problem arrives, is to kind of know what you're thinking about so that you can make the right choice when the moment comes, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
There are communities exploring network geothermal too. We have one in Framingham.
Mm-hmm.
That is a way to energize a whole neighborhood with, instead of having gas lines running to their house, they'll have hot and cold water pumped to their house for heating and cooling. That's another future thing.
Interesting. So I guess the last question, I mean, I know that you are involved here in our hometown with working to make other people aware of these opportunities, right? With you've got have led, something called Energize Franklin. What's that? How can people learn from that site? What should people do?
Yeah, well, thanks for that question. EnergizeFranklin.org is a website. The motto is helping neighbors make climate friendly decisions. And there's all kinds of advice there and links to other websites where you can learn about solar panels, heat pumps, EVs. We do periodically have events. We have the Strawberry Stroll and the Harvest Festival in Franklin, where we have a 10x10 booth where people can stop by and talk to us and meet us and so forth. And, more good things to come. We just started the site last year, so we're a young and growing group. But, a lot of good things happening in Franklin on climate, and we're trying to be part of that.
So anybody who is decarbonizing curious, I guess I should say, that it wants to find out about that, there are ways to learn, right? And you can learn a lot and prepare yourself for the things that are coming down the pike. And that's a good thing, right?
Yeah. And if by any chance you live in a neighboring town, we certainly welcome neighbors in Bellingham and Medway and all the surrounding towns to use the site as well.
And I should say that even the organization you're with is part of a Massachusetts statewide effort. So there's a lot of towns that have similar efforts as to what you're doing, and people can check it out. They can probably go to your site and find their way to other towns, maybe their own, that has this sort of effort underway, right?
We have an events page, and sometimes we'll post events in other towns. There's a lot of stuff going on in Framingham and Natick and Wayland and Lexington and Concord. And, a lot of good stuff. So,
That's great to hear.
Mass Energize is the parent organization, so massenergize.org. And we all have similar models with testimonials is a big part of it, where we encourage people to get on there and talk about their own climate voyage, as it were, and what their experiences have been with trying to decarbonize.
Super. Well, thank you very much, David, for coming on. We should put it down here. Let me say, dear listener, if you have any comments or ideas about shows, or if you have a decarbonization story you want to tell, please send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be talking about. You're probably listening to this show on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps like Spotify or Apple or Google. Guess what? The Climate Minute is on all of those. Please ask your friends to listen to this podcast on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, David, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Ted. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.